Officer of the Heritage Victoria. And with her is Jane Harrington, who...
Archaeologist, yes.
So we're... Good, thank you. We're really pleased to have you both here today to... And when Barbara rang Sarah to see what the title should be for the National Trust publications, she quickly thought of Why We Dive and Why We Dig. And I think that's very appropriate for the theme of Culture Down Under. So we do look forward to hearing what you have to tell us, Sarah and Jane.
I'd like to, am I coming through?
Yes.
Good. I'd like to thank Barbara for inviting us to come here today. Heritage Victoria is an agency of the Heritage Council. We provide the legislation that protects places, objects, of state significance, to those things in Victoria which are regarded to be so important to understanding our cultural heritage that they need to be protected. Now, most people, when they think of heritage, think of heritage buildings, of course. Images come to people's heads of Como, I suppose, with an easy one, or Parliament House. But people like yourselves in historical societies, of course, realise the idea of heritage is much wider than that. So I know one particular interest in this group, for example, is the brickworks in your particular community and industrial sites. What people don't often realise is that we can also protect things such as archaeological sites and shipwrecks as well. So our purpose here today is to give you examples of one archaeological site in the Melbourne area we've been working on, and Jane's been very much involved in that. Feel free to interrupt if you want to feed in. And also a shipwreck. And people always love talking about shipwrecks because they're very exciting and very glamorous. But also, shipwrecks can tell us an enormous amount about our past that we can't get from other sources, just as land archaeological sites can do as well. So I'll just go on and talk about the two particular sites. If you want to ask questions as I go through, please feel free, and to myself or for Jane. Jane's the actual professional archaeologist, so she'll be able to answer a lot of your technical questions that you may have. Okay, the site we're going to talk about, first of all, is Viewbank, the Viewbank Homestead site. Has anybody heard of that?
Heard of the name.
Heard of the name, yep. Well, this site is in Heidelberg, in the Banyul area, and it's a site of a homestead that was built within the first few years of the settlement at Port Phillip, so 1837, and I can't believe I left my notes at the back there. I'll just grab them. Sorry, it's very poor organisation.
They identified that there was quite a significant, from historical records, that there was likely to be a significant site there, and from on-ground records from the survey, you could see that there obviously was the remains of quite a large structure. And that's where we were given information about it. We then placed it on the inventory, if you like, with recommendations, and it was a site that was potentially going to give us a lot of information and was going to be quite significant historically to the state of Victoria. And so it's people like Gary Vines, for example, with the work that they're doing, who bring sites like this. This wasn't Gary Vines in particular, but who do bring sites like this to our attention, which is where the stage, like, where we got involved with it.
What we knew about the Viewbank homestead before the actual excavation started was that it had been built... the area had been farmed a few years after the settlement at the Port Phillip settlement, and that It had been demolished sometime prior to 1922. At some stage there was quite a large structure there, a homestead, but there's no pictures or pictorial record of what the actual building looks like, and there's no actual plan of what the building looked like. So it's a real treasure hunt, this particular dig, in a way, because we'll learn so much. We don't have anything to really go by initially to start with, apart from the initial structures. Anyway, just briefly, Viewbank operated as a large homestead for a big landowner family called Dr. Robert Martin until the late 19th century. Then the land was sold off and it became part of a dairy farm. And then eventually, about 1922, we're not quite sure when the building was actually demolished. And then we're up to this stage now. So that's a brief view. And I'll take you through some of the slides. So we're talking about Melbourne here in the very early days of settlement, and you can see the very little settlement has actually occurred. And Heidelberg was one of those areas where squatters from New South Wales and Tasmania came because there was they'd run out of runs in that particular area. And they lived the normal life they lived. Now, Sir Robert Martin took up the Viewbank property in 1844. Now, when he took up the property, there was an actual structure on that particular site, which we believe, I think, was about a four-bedroomed weatherboard structure, we think. And he added to that and extended to that over time. That's a diagram of the run in the documents. We have some documentary evidence of the actual story. We do have oral history records about what the building looked like when David Martin was there. Yes? Yep, sure. I'll grab those tar. We do have some oral records as to what the building...
Shut the door.
Yeah. Excuse me, sorry. No, that'd be better. What the actual building looked like, and that is that it was brick, it was single storey, it had a veranda, low gable, French windows, and it may have been prefabricated. But again, we have very little idea what it really looked like, so that's where the archaeology comes in. Okay, as I said, it then later became a dairy run by the Bartrams, and on the actual site we have the two dairies, which the two rooms of the dairies, we actually now use as our site offices when we stay there. We have a fridge and things like that set up. And also, there are these things on the actual site. Does anybody like to know, take a guess of what these are? They're silos, but they're quite unusual because they were built in the 1930s and they were homemade silos that the Bartrams actually built there. And when you actually come towards the site, they're quite distinctive. They're almost like little turrets sitting up there. At the moment, the land, as Jane has said, is being used by Parks and Waterways. And they're hoping perhaps to use the site for sort of tourist historical interpretations later. Anyway, let's get to the dig. Oh, sorry, not the dig first of all. We'll get to the present inhabitants of the area around Viewbank and the electric fence. The area around there is used now for registering cattle.
Just a comment, it's quite funny trying to do the sort of work we were doing out there, because I think most people probably were cattle are very curious, and they found very interested in what was going on, and they were particularly interested. Our nice pile. And the other thing they discovered is the cars, and we're blissfully licking the tops of the cars away. But so we did, and also basically because of avoiding damage to the site by the cattle, and also potential damage to the cattle by them falling into holes, we finally did get the rangers to put a fence up around it. But and I can vouch for the electricity box running through.
Okay, now this is an aerial shot of where we're talking about, and most of you would be able to recognise how we can tell where the site was from an aerial photo. Yep, Joan?
One of the things that becomes important for us is mostly what is left is remnant vegetation or planting, And so the interesting thing for us here is you can see the driveway that was coming up here and the plantings that were put in around the house. The other interesting thing that the aerial photo shows is there was quite a deal of terracing done here, and when the grass is cut down, you can see these quite large terraces where they've landscaped the area. And it's, the aerial photos do help us with being able to show where there were other roads coming into the site, because one of the things that turned out here is it's quite evident that they changed the entranceway with the development of the roads in the areas. But these tree-lined driveways are quite common as an indicative element when we are looking at large homestead sites. Mm.
I'll just flip forward to the next one, Joan.
Can I just ask to get our bearings, that road on the left there? Is that Plenty Road?
We're on
Banyule Road.
That one.
Banyule Road.
Yes.
There's the they're the silos there. Mm-hmm. Remember, I touched the silos there.
And the house up here, which is now used, I think, as
it's a recreation centre.
This was part of the built as part of the dairy.
The dairy, yeah.
Now the other thing, I don't know if it's easy to see on this photo, but
so I've got an old 45 one. Is that better?
So you can see these sorts of things coming out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which and again, indicative that there were structures there. Mm. And
This is a 1945 shot, and apparently it was a very, very dry summer, which is apparently excellent if you're going to take aerial shots because you've got less bush. If you compare the two of them, one of the most obvious differences is that... Oh, sorry, wrong way. Is that you have here, of course, the growth of suburbia all around you. And one reason why this site is so important is because it's quite close to the city. A lot of these old sites would over time have been built over where people lived in that time. So it's quite unusual, I'd say. Sorry? The Plenty? Yeah, the Plenty.
No, it's the
Arrow. Sorry, what I said? I always do that. And there's various bodies of water on
there
as well.
The other thing, again, because there may have been quite a lot of usage of the river, that there are some remnants down here as well, which various people have interpreted as being associated with maybe a boat shed.
Mm.
But that's not an area at this stage. We've investigated thoroughly enough to be able to say whether it is or it isn't, and whether it was associated with Martin's occupation, or whether it was later associated with the dairy, or whether it's just a recreational addition that's much later.
What is the built-up area on the right, please?
We're looking over towards... I think that's mostly Rosanna.
Yeah, that's more Rosanna. Yeah.
Rosanna.
Mm. And this actual part of the suburb here is called View Bank.
The land up above, where the trees sort of, in order.
There?
Is that
used? I have no idea.
They're not doing an archaeological
The whole area.
It's trees seem to be in such a line, you know.
Yeah, so I don't know, maybe it was windbreaks when it was farmland, I'm not sure. Again, there's the far more, the different sort of view you get in those suburbs. And as we've said, of course, there's lots of European trees on the site. Another association with this particular area is, of course, with the Heidelberg School. Mm-hmm. So when you're actually on the site, you can get a feeling of those type of colours that come through in the Tom Roberts painting, of those when Heidelberg was a rural area. And when you sort of move away from the site and drive back along the road, you get quite a different impression. So that's another important association for our cultural heritage. So that, is that the fig tree?
Yep.
That's the big fig tree. So that's over 100 years old. Mm.
There's Morton Bay, is it?
I think so. There's actually a person standing there. So you can see that gives you a sense of the... Okay, and that again is that sort of Heidelberg view type of school type of view. But again, we have, of course, the subs. All this area is going to be used for recreational land by parks and water, but the green belt through there. Okay, let's go on. There also is a billabong on the site as well, which is quite large. I'm not sure whether we know where they got their water from. we established that yet?
No,
I'm not sure.
We haven't found any evidence that we've had some, possibly that we've had wells up there.
Okay, well, this is the very wet and cold day when the first excavation started, and as well as professional archaeologists, we also rely on quite a lot of volunteers who actually do the digging. Many of these are university students, but also local people and members of local historical societies come in as well. And basically, the dig couldn't happen unless we had that type of assistance. So here we are drawing out the
trenches.
We
laid out four large trenches across where we could easily identify what the main part of the homestead area, with a view of trying to establish where the actual footings were, the growth of the building on the basis of what those footings could possibly tell us. And obviously we're very interested in the artifact material that's coming up. So we laid out a series of four trenches with 50 centimetre baulks between those trenches. The first step was to remove this grass cover before we started to do something that was perhaps a little bit more systematic.
You can see, in fact, how long that actually was.
There was a lot of grass and it was very wet at that time. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and
after a lot of work had been
so we've skipped forward about roughly a week, would it be?
We ran it, the first season we ran a 3-week season, and this would have been getting pretty close into halfway through the second week into the third week. But as you can see, we've uncovered quite a substantial amount of the building. Mm. And this was a particularly interesting area because it turned out that with most of our artifact material that was intact and very interesting came out of here and out of this area up here. And at this stage, we've interpreted this area as being something that was originally a veranda area, but later perhaps was developed into another room. And I think because it would have been in the veranda stage that a lot of this interesting artifact material would have basically been dropped through. Mm. That's where we found things like small pen knives, an apostle spoon,
and
lots of little toys.
Little toys and things. So maybe it was a little sort of toy area, play area, where verandas often were. And you can see in the back there the dirt. I mean, there's piles of dirt and piles of bricks. And remember, the house was actually demolished as well. So some actual materials had been taken away for scrap and actually sold. But other materials had stayed there, in particularly the bricks.
From our point of view, knowing that the house was demolished at a particular time was very helpful and made this site more significant than, for example, something that might have been demolished in the 1990s, because we know that there was a cut-off time when any material that was there would have to have been put there prior to that date.
Mm.
So that helps us very much with our interpretation. And so when we found things like far more recent material, we'd know it had been deposited by visitors to the site, but wasn't relevant to our interpretation of what was actually going on here.
Mm.
And what about the bricks? Did they tell you anything?
The bricks are mostly handmade. It's very hard to tell much from bricks unless they start to be machine made and you get some indication from names on them to give you an idea where they came from.
Mm.
But most of these bricks would have probably been made on the site, and I would imagine most of you have probably seen handmade bricks and they're interesting just to see the thumbprints. We found lots of thumbprints on them. What we would really like to do is find the clay pit where
the bricks
we
believe
they were manufactured on the site, where they were coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And we did do some, Sarah will probably get onto this, but we did some later excavations this year in an area which we thought might be, but it's actually too shallow, I think, to have been what they would have been using for a clay pit in this area. And we're very careful about storing intact bricks as against very badly damaged bricks. And Parks and Waterways have taken these away and stored them in an area. So if at any later time we look at interpretation works, we've still got some intact material that we can use.
And what happened in some parts of the building was the bricks walls were actually collapsed into the building to fill up holes so the cattle who are using this area wouldn't actually fall in it. So there's some slides showing that sort of amazing layers and layers of brick. That's a nice shot there, I think. And you can really get here a sense of the building coming to life and being not just a
does that just cover over for a period of time?
This particular building.
No, it's because it's really only one occupation layer. I think the exciting thing with Australian archaeology is that your second occupation layer or your lower occupation layer could be Aboriginal. What we were looking for, though, in this case was because we were aware that there was a small building on the site prior to Dr. Martin building his homestead, the question, one of our research questions is, did he expand that house? Or was that house actually on another site? And that's, again, we haven't done enough to categorically answer that, but that's what we're looking at. We do know, however, that there were different stages of development of the house, and you can tell that by the quality of the later foundations, that there is two separate types of foundations there.
I think actually... Yeah, I've got actually got a diagram showing the thing. Later on, this example of the bricks being thrown in. Yep.
Do we know why they demolished it in 1922?
It was derelict. Yeah. It was a derelict house. The Bartrams hadn't actually lived in it. They'd built their own house when they set off the dairy. I guess it had been tenanted after Dr. Martin died in 1875. Basically, it was tenanted and... For many years, and it was known locally in the area, apparently the local kids, as a haunted house, which you could imagine on the hill. And it was, I guess, the Bartrams would have seen a dirty old-fashioned house, basically. I mean, we'd see it quite differently today if it was still around. But yeah.
How would just that land remain without development on it?
Because it was a dairy farming area, and I don't know quite when Park and Waterways bought it, in the 70s. So it was farming right the way to 70s, in Heidelberg. Yeah, in Heidelberg, yeah. So that's quite, that was lucky, really.
That's why, it obviously is a very, it's an incredibly significant site, because there just are so few areas like that are so close to the central part of Melbourne.
And the building can tell us about that sort of changing land use. I mean, the area from... a gentleman farmer up to a dairy farm up to suburbia, coming around it.
We did have a historian do some background research, and I think some of the stories that come out are quite sad too, because I think one of the reasons the property was left because there must have been an accident. I think
His daughter and his grandchildren died in a shipwreck. Coming from, I think they were coming from India or coming back from Britain via India. So he lost his daughter, he was very close to, and he financially he didn't go into a decline, but emotionally he'd basically lost interest in his life. So we've managed to pick up certain parts of the story, and he himself was quite an influential man in the local area. He was on the local roads board and things like that. So, but yeah, those sort of it's going in those sort of people stories in there.
And one of his daughters married into the family.
The Boyds.
So yeah. There's all quite a connection with the whole Heidelberg area.
This is a site plan? Probably the right. Well, I was going to say map, but I knew that wasn't right. Okay, and is that focused enough?
Not particularly.
Okay, I'll just do that. Is it better? Is that right? Okay.
Just to give you an idea, this is the area we pointed out that was the verandah area in here. This, the big tree is up
there
in this corner.
And you can see the house actually had two wings that they think were added on in Dr. Martin's time, or built when Dr. Martin was there. And I think if if I'm right, Jane, that this part may be the older part of the house, this section here, because the quality of the brickwork and the stonework in the front part is of much higher quality. So it wasn't just a house that was whipped up in the first few years of settlement. And the terracing comes down here. So we're looking on the hill there.
And the other thing, because of the vegetation, there is a couple of pines that stand here with some, we've slightly excavated an area of stairs stepping down into the terracing. So there are visible stairs as well that are appearing all the way through it. And it's quite terraced up here, and there's some stairs popping down.
So you can imagine him coming down the stairs and having this wonderful view over the river and the and the valley. I'll show you some of the one of the things that came out of the I can never say that word. Excavation was you can tell me that there. That is the cornicing. It's plaster. It actually comes in. See, it's quite thick. You see how it's coloured, sort of purpley, greeny colour. Now, this house is quite unusual, the plaster we found, because it's only actually had one layer of wallpaper on it, which is quite unusual, because many, many places have many layers. You may have read the article about Como, about Rip and Lee, and how they've got so many layers, and how do they decide which one to restore it in. Well, this one only has one. But it's a very... I brought a few pieces to show you, so I can show them to you later on. But it's quite an intricate pattern, and initially we thought that there were three or four wallpapers over each other. Then our conservators worked out it was only one. It was just very, very... very complex. But this, of course, is very useful because it tells us the type of materials that we use and the type of styles that we use. And we presume that was done when the extension was done, as it's only the first one. And again, with the demolition, all the plaster work just basically came in. Okay, and this is terrible. You can see here different materials used. There's actually some wooden, I think they're beginning of door frames there as well. But quite a different types of materials were shown in the excavation. I think that's actually, is that a cup there, Jane? No, it's not a cup, is it? It's a bit of plaster.
I think it's more like a bit of plaster.
Yeah.
It's like a cup, you're right.
But sometimes in the walls, I had a work experience student working there who actually found half a jug, which was actually in the wall of the building. So obviously the workmen, when they were putting together the wall, must have broken something and thrown that in as a bit more of a thing. So, okay, this is the cellar area, and you can see the cellar has in fact been all filled in with bricks. So one of the jobs we had last time we were there was actually we cleared most of that out. And so we're hoping once that cleared out, the cellar will perhaps show us some good treasures. Because it's quite deep, isn't it, Jane?
It is very deep.
Hmm.
And it's very hard. That was hard work to get down to where we slowed.
Yeah,
it was very slow.
Yeah.
And with that, we just ran one of what's called a sounding, because the work involved with clearing the whole area was sort of beyond our resources at the time.
Hmm. And, archaeology isn't particularly glamorous. A lot of it's just back-breaking work, just moving dirt and moving bricks. Again, a mixture of materials here. See the wood and the plaster and the brick. And, this gives you an indication of when the bricks actually came in. Actually, almost see the formation of the wall there when it came in. But you can see the depth there. Hours of work. Oh, sorry.
That gets a bit tricky when you're first excavating it too, because your first thought is, well, have I got a brick floor, or is it a collapsed layer? Mm-hmm. We had no brick floors; they were all collapsed layers that turned out.
Are these stones that have been brought in for that?
They're all
there. Are they stone?
Yep.
These. Yep. So the foundations were stone. Local stone.
So
yeah.
Sort of up from the river. Would it be?
Yeah. Probably where I'm going.
Mm. Okay, now this is an interesting section. This is in the what we think is the older part of the house, which is in the top right-hand corner, if we went back to the diagram. There wasn't an awful lot of big metal structures in the building. As the place was demolished, a lot of that sort of stuff would have been sold off for scrap. But there were these two things, and the theories are they are...
Someone thought it was a cool box.
I've heard someone say it was maybe part of a stove or the...
Part of a stove. But again, they're the sorts of questions that remain unanswered. And it's very hard to categorically say one or the other. So if anyone has any suggestions, please.
What are they constructed of?
I'm not quite sure, but I think they're just steel.
Mm. Well, the way they've been about, they look as though they could have been gold mined below.
Mm.
And to my mind, being a plumber, they look not unlike a rain head. What a rain head is, a rainwater box.
Oh, yeah. All right.
just looking at them from the distance.
Mm.
Yes.
Yep.
So the outlet on the lower right-hand corner.
Yeah.
Is that like the downpipe?
Oh, I see, down there.
Yeah.
Oh, right,
it's
yeah.
Sort of one up on the other one too, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. We'll take your name.
Yeah, right. I've been involved in the station, so I know all about it.
Oh, right, yeah. But the quality of the building in this particular area is much lower than the two wings at the front. Yeah, this is an interesting find we had. In here, we found... some slate, what do you call them?
It's a grate. It's a ventilation
grate here. Right. It was actually made of slate, which apparently, I think it's the only one we've found in Victoria, or?
We're aware of,
yeah. So that dates the time before they actually had metallic materials to build it from, and there we have found a few of those. That's amazing that's actually survived, because slate, as you know, is quite brittle.
I think it was at the homestead of Summers, Cooler.
Cooler.
I'm pretty sure they used a lot of slate for the benches in the dairy or the cool room.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think I've seen it used for that purpose.
Oh, right. There wasn't much slate actually in the dig, was there?
Oh, that's quite a lot. Yeah, there's lots of slate coming off, but most of it would have been from the roof. There wasn't as much as you would expect would be on the roof,
yeah.
But they probably would have sold that off as part of the demolition.
And just some more areas of it. Okay, and of course, different materials and different additions are made. You can see here a lot of metallic objects here that have been collected.
And obviously when you're starting to get something like a concrete floor, it's a much later addition into the property.
Mm.
And we wondered about whether this wasn't a kitchen, later became the kitchen area or the garage. We're still not sure about the kitchen. Early on, there's still... the probability that it was separate from the main building.
Mm.
So we are aware that there are other small buildings dotted around, but that would be our next stage of investigation to go and have a look at
because of fire and history.
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. And this may have been when they decided to add the kitchen to the house. It might have been part of that there, or an outside area that they then built around. We haven't gone far enough yet to be able to answer that.
It's quite a big structure. Mm. I was really surprised. Mm. It's a substantial mansion. Okay, now this is a bit of a quiz for you. we think we know what these are. Do we know what they may be? They're metallic objects. I'm going to focus it a bit more.
Yes, I think so.
Yep, okay.
Are they dry well?
No. They're actually inside the house, in the older part of the house.
Yeah.
So not where the family were living.
Around the doorknob?
No.
How big are they?
You can see the door underneath them.
Only quite small.
Yeah.
So they might be ceiling roses.
No. They look like bicycle bells. In fact, we think they were servant bells.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And when we have these objects, of course, they need to go to conservation and the conservators actually pull them apart and clean them and treat them so they'll... And There's quite a complex mechanism actually inside them. That's what we actually think they were. And they're quite, most servants' bells I've seen have actually been almost like bells on a hook type of thing. But these are actually like look like bicycle bells, you know, like with a cap and a spring type of thing. So they're
and
quite different.
Them, actually, I have to say with I. It's very exciting when all you're getting is bottle, glass and brick.
Yeah.
There were several close together, so that was again another question. Why would you have more than one in a small area? And plus, prior to this, we'd found some very interesting objects in the other trenches that what the best we could come up with, we thought, were sort of almost picture hangers that seemed to have a small rectangle with little wires hanging off them. And we found some more close to here. And then we thought, well, maybe what we have here is a system throughout the whole building that was a bell system.
I think in the servants' quarters, you know, one bell ring for the upstairs
And we know the Martins did have staff.
Yeah.
There was some extent they had coachmen and they had a few servants apparently. Now this is one of I guess fairly common things found in sites in Australia.
Yeah,
that's right. The clay pie.
Is this one
of the engraving? Yes, it's actually got a ship on it. Yeah. It's an engraved ship on it. So you're probably aware a lot of them are quite intricately carved. And this, which is another mystery object, and there's no right answer. I've actually brought this with me. So it's really tiny. I mean, you can't see it, but that gives you an idea of the shape. Mm. As you can see, it's a little fish. And we've had a few theories as to what this is. One person suggested it was a fishing lure, but we can't actually find any things to connect it to a rod. And someone suggests something to do with weaving, some sort of shuttle implement. But it could just be something decorative. So it could be a toy. Yeah.
What do you know?
Wood. Yeah. And it survived, which is and it's quite pretty. Yeah. Well, hang on, look at it. Close up, it's quite gorgeous, yeah. And of course the belt buckles. Okay, and of course the dreaded bottles. This is where we give our speech about the problems with people collecting bottles, bottle collection. I don't want to offend any bottle collectors in the room now. But one problem we have with it, once these sort of sites become public, it's often people with metal detectors come in and try and find things, and also bottle collectors come in. And when they do that, they're just there for one reason, and that is the bottles. And in that situation, often a lot of really good information is actually lost. So it's very difficult for us. So often that's why I suppose sometimes archaeological sites aren't particularly well publicised.
Because and we did have that problem here. Mm. After some information appeared in the local press, and within a week, the tip area had been plundered.
Yeah. So when we're actually doing the excavations, of course, that the actual layers are completely mucked up. So
anyone can go to the site? Well, you have to jump the fence, but yes. Yeah,
get past the cows. Yeah, but yes.
And the well-trained tiger.
No.
There's just, I suppose, because it's really public land.
It is public land,
but
yeah.
But because they do have cows and the cattle in there at the moment, it's very...
Last weekend or so, they had the open day at Penny's Orchard. They had conducted tours to Pontville.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we're doing
a similar site. Mm-hmm.
We're doing work there at the moment.
Yeah,
we're very involved with that.
You've constructed a cyclone fence right around the site now to protect it from the public.
Mm-hmm.
Have you done the same thing here?
No, we haven't.
Should it be done?
It's too large a site to do it, I think. Pontville is a much more discreet site. I haven't been to Pontville. I've just dealt with it the person who knows the site well hasn't been there.
Well, they put a cyclone fence around the homestead area to protect the
Yeah, this is a very big site. I mean, how many actors?
Yeah, well, a few, eh? The infamous financial resources.
Yeah.
We don't actually have the funds to be able to do that, and Melbourne Parks and Waterway haven't got excited about doing it. They have put up electric fences around to keep the cattle out, though.
Going back to that one, is there any point in contacting Laurel or somebody like that that deals in cyclone fencing?
Oh, I think that
there's... sponsorship?
Next year, we're actually looking at that because we're going to run a very big season there next year, and I think it'll become a bigger issue then.
Yeah, sure.
And as part of that, we will have to start considering security.
And lots of volunteers. So if any of you are good shifting bricks, we do actually have a volunteer communication with people. So if you add to our mailing list, we can let you know when it's actually happening.
I have got friends at Pontville.
Yeah. Okay, and of course we find things like kitchen implements. And
lots of nails.
Lots and lots of nails. So they're some of the type we've seen. Yep, fine.
Just getting back to the nails.
Yep. And that's a
we have a collection of handmade nails which were donated from one of the early members of our foundation member of our Blacksmiths Association.
Oh yeah.
They're now housed under a park museum. And they date back from Camden Court Palace in London.
Oh right.
The
thoughts,
lots of the hands.
It's like,
I think they were bone,
because of that sort of, yeah. But it's quite long tines, aren't they? Tines there, yeah. Okay, anyway, so I think I've gone past my half an hour already. I'm only halfway through, so... Would you like to sum up before I go on to shipwrecks, Jane?
Just that it's been a very exciting project for us, and it's the first one that Heritage Victoria has had the opportunity to initiate and run. Unfortunately, this sort of research is very rare in archaeology in Victoria because of the limited resources from a government point of view. Mm. Most of the work that happens is development driven, and the excavations only get done when there's a road about to go through the middle of it. So this has been, I think this is really important from us as an organisation being able to contribute from an educational point of view and a research point of view to what's going on. And it's an interesting project, and we are hoping to get a greater amount of funding to run it at a much bigger excavation next year. And just to follow up on what Sarah said, if anyone is interested, we're very keen to have anybody along. We can let you know when it's happening. Probably we usually look at a good time of year is sort of March, April.
Mm.
So that's the sort of time that we've been doing something like this.
And it's really exciting to do. I mean, it's hard work and you're exhausted and you're dirty and filthy, but you really feel you learn a lot and you really feel you're contributing. It's very exciting.
And we have a lot of fun.
And we have a lot of fun too, which is really good.
Just to follow up on it's not just for people who feel that they don't particularly want to be lugging bricks around. We also obviously bring a lot of artifact material up, and we have to look after that. So down in what was the dairy house that you saw, we have quite a busy team of people also working, washing and just storing the artifact material as well. So there is sort of less strenuous work for anyone who wants a bit of hands-on.
And that's what does our conservator say? Excavation without conservation is vandalism. Mm-hmm. So, which is one of the problems, and that fits in quite nicely to maritime archaeology. Okay. Now, when I first started Heritage Victoria, which was only a few months ago, I had no idea such things as maritime archaeologists actually existed. But they do, they're alive and well, and they're working at Heritage Victoria. Every shipwreck in Victoria over 75 years old is protected under legislation in Victoria. And there are roughly about 670-something shipwrecks, about three-quarters have actually been located in Victorian waters. And as I said earlier, These particular sites are enormously important for us to learn about our cultural heritage, especially since the sea and navigation has played such an important part in the European settlement of Victoria, trade, immigration, development of goods, exporting, etc. The particular wreck I'm going to be talking about today is called the William Salt House. And I thought this would be a nice one to do because it fits in quite well with Viewbank. Again, my dates. It was built in 1824 as a British trading vessel, and in 1841 it was coming from Canada to Port Phillip Bay with lots and lots of goods for the new settlement there. And strangely enough, just in across this ship. And often what happens with wrecks is they're actually hidden for many years, but with changes in tide, certain weather conditions, they'll actually be revealed. And that happened in this particular case. Now, unfortunately, just as we have bottle collectors who are of some concern with land archaeology, some members of the diving community, in fact, are private collectors as well, and they do, in fact, go into wrecks looking for treasure. I see it as a bit of a Biggles sort of approach to Treasure Island sort of approach to wrecks, basically. And in fact, divers used to actually literally blow up, use explosives, underwater explosives, actually blow up wrecks to actually try and locate gold, perhaps metallic objects and things like that. So that's one of the reasons why we actually have the legal protection of the actual wrecks, because as you can imagine, I mean, if you went over to Viewbank and put a stick of dynamite in there and blew that up, what would you lose? Exactly the same thing happens with the shipwreck. That unfortunately did happen with the William Salt House. Word got out amongst the diving community that that this wreck was there, and quite a lot of damage was actually done to it. And so Heritage Victoria went out to investigate. We have groups of archaeologists who are divers. They specialise in marine archaeology, and they actually go out and do the work of archaeologists, except they're doing it wet, I suppose you can say.
Just to put in a good word, though, for the diving community as well, they have had quite a large about-turn and have become much more self-regulatory,
And most of those people who were there would probably be volunteers who are really just recreational divers. They do a lot of work with this. And the other people who do a lot of work with this are the police divers. They're very keen to help. So I would suspect that on that boat you probably only have three or four people who actually work with us. And the rest would be very helpful volunteers.
And the police rescue dives particularly like getting involved because often the wrecks are quite deep and quite dangerous. It means they can actually practice their skills as well as contributing something to the state. Anyway, the actual site was actually protected because of the amount of damage, and of course because it was such an old site and a lot of it was intact. So in fact now, as it says there, it's a protected zone, no boats or diving within 250 metres. So now legally you need to get permission from the Maritime Heritage Victoria, our organisation, to actually dive in that particular area. Okay, right, now divers, as I said, maritime archaeologists work similarly to land archaeologists, except of course there are certain difficulties in doing their job which land archaeologists don't have. For example, with diving, they may be able to spend only 2 hours a time on actually down there on one particular dive. And of course they have to use the same sort of material that the land archaeologists use, but of course they have to be waterproof. With the William Salt House, when the archaeologists went down there in 1983 to do a survey for 6 weeks, they dug two trenches. The first thing they actually had to do was actually lay out grid lines so they could actually map what the site looked like, so that whenever they found an artefact they could locate exactly what it is. And as you can see, it's not like getting a bit of string out. And of course they need to have drawings as they actually take things out for the particular site. And I think that's pretty amazing technology myself, being able to ride underwater. And of course photos were taken throughout the entire time. And of course these were the actual lines that were drawn around, I think. They actually put pipes around it to actually measure out the particular area. And again, the same type of techniques perhaps which land archaeologists use, tags to actually identify where things are so people can map them. Look, I may just very quickly go back to the... Go back to the very first slide, and I'll flip back again. This is the type of thing you find when you find a wreck. When the divers first found the William Salt House, they actually found the shape like that. But a lot of that had collapsed by the time the other divers had come through with crowbars and actually smashed it up. So what you actually have is basically something like that. When you start off with, I mean, some wrecks you don't find very much at all. So, and of course, in this situation as well, changing weather conditions will also change what happens with the wreck. So you may have sand coming over it and things like that. So you're working under lots of different types of difficulties. Okay, where were we? Now, let me recognise what that may be there. No, it does actually, yeah. You're right, yeah. Actually, it's a part of a barrel. Most of the transportation of goods in that time were actually in barrels, of course. And we have, there were over 1,000 casks or barrels actually on the William Salt House. And they were carrying things like whiskey, nails, cider, vinegar, flour, and a lot of meat as well, a lot of salted pork, a lot of salted beef. In lots of cases the bones, and in some cases even parts of the meat were actually still there as well. The crew would, of course, eaten salted meat on the trip. One reference I read suggests that, in fact, they prefer to capture rats and kill them and eat them themselves rather than actually eat the salted meat. So this particular wreck tells a lot about the type of things that people things that had to be imported into the settlement, and also the type of techniques that were used to build them. And that gives you a bit of an overview book of the wreck. And you can see there the anchor chain there. So what we're mainly bringing up is metallic objects, wooden objects. Not very much fabric is actually found. If I think in our collection we've only got one piece of fabric, and sometimes leather as well. Okay, and there you can see the divers working. Quite dusty down there as well. And again, are they the bell? Sorry, I want to see them at a particular angle. Here.
Someone has written a very interesting piece of just on the barrel.
So, there we go. What I think is interesting is the fact that the Williams Salt House is actually trading from Canada to Port Phillip. This is the time during the Navigation Acts when the colonies weren't actually meant to trade between themselves, according to British legislation at the time. So in fact they were doing a bit of a sneaky apparently. Let me see in there what looks like wicker. Another thing the William Salt House held was, I'll go back to that one, was wicker baskets. And these wicker baskets were filled with champagne bottles. And some of them, in fact, the cork hadn't actually been destroyed. And champagne in Melbourne was one of the most favourite drinks. There were, in fact, 20 baskets of champagne that were being imported into Melbourne. And remember, there were 50 public houses, 50 pubs in Melbourne in 1841. So, yep. And that was in the little Lonsdale dig in Melbourne, and they also found a lot of champagne bottles as well. So Melbourne's quite
famous
for that.
Interesting, though, because they were full, and actually the Heritage Victoria Lutheran Museum ran a public wine tasting with several very eminent wine tasters, including James Halliday, and I was lucky enough to get some. I was doing the runaround at festival on that particular day, and happened to be there when they did a formal non-public tasting, and I had the opportunity to taste the champagne.
Oh, did you? I didn't know that.
It was horrible.
It was 141 years old.
Well, you never get a chance to taste this sort of stuff.
This is sort of, yeah, go on.
You made a big type of bottles you made at Burien. The bottles in the wicker baskets were like you could use to make a Burien, you know, the model ship.
Oh, yeah, they're quite big, aren't they?
Yeah.
But very thick and very dark.
Not quite as big as a magnum, no, they were still normal.
Very solid. This is sort of, when we bring metallic objects up, this is often the condition they're in. And it's very important that they get straight into conservation. If once they're removed from the water in the open air, then they degrade very quickly. And that's one of the problems with people actually taking things from ships. They don't look after them, basically. As I said, vandalism. So a lot of really good objects are actually lost. I mean, things actually have to be soaked in distilled water for
months? The main problem is that as they dry, of course, the salt crystallises, and as it crystallises, it disturbs the surface area and breaks it up. So there is a real problem that we need to keep them in equilibrium when we bring them up, so they are stored
in water.
Water surrounding.
And also, wrecks are also home to many animals as well. And I've never been diving. Jane's dived. I haven't dived. Apparently, there's another world down there, and a very beautiful. So, yeah. And so the divers talk about, you know, fish sort of talking to them as well. Okay, this is a bilge pump. this has actually been brought up into our collection, and that was used for actually pumping water out of the ship. And it's made out of lead and leather. I wonder how that you got it up, actually. There's another view of it there. So we actually, in the collection, we also, by bringing these sort of things up, we also get an idea of the type of technology that was used in those particular times. When I first saw this slide, I thought it was, you know, a nice pot or something like that. I talked to the marine archaeologist and it's a bilge pump, so it, you know, lost a bit of its romance. Okay, and here again you can see the barrels over there. And a lot of the barrel lids as well. This one's the one I was telling you that it's actually got Montreal written on it, 1841 Montreal. And that was really exciting because, as I said, it showed that people were actually trading between the colonies where they weren't meant to. I bought another one for you to have a look at, which was actually brought up from there as well. But you can see that gives you an idea of the type of size of the actual ones there.
From the eastern part of Canada,
No, it would have been eastern Canada. No, it would have been the eastern Canada. Yeah. So it's a long trip, and all that. They could have actually picked up things on the way, but I think that those particular barrels actually had the meat in them. So the meat and the champagne together sounds like a pretty ordinary type of meal. Okay, and again, there's the wicker baskets again. There are also 20 cases of Saturn that were brought over as well. But I was quite surprised when I saw how the wicker had actually been preserved. I mean, maybe it was just covered up in the sand and that preserved it. Okay, and again, the divers just doing their stuff. Ah, now, these are actually the bottles. They're in the water. Yeah, you can just see the basket around the edge. So it shows you the sand over 141 years, the sand is just covered it up. Okay, and so as we had the site drawing with View Bank, also we have, of course, the site drawing with the William Salt House. So laying out where was found what and things like that. And that's the first trench. Two trenches were dug on the first day. Dug in marine archaeology? Dug, yeah.
Still appropriate
term.
Just a bit more difficult.
Yeah. And this is another area there. So everything's basically plotted out and recorded. A lot of archaeology, from my observation, seems to be everything needs to be recorded, and it's a very exacting task. It's not sort of just glamour, etc. Okay, again, another picture of the an actual sketch drawing of one of the barrel heads. That's the one we saw earlier. Two actual drawings are taken as well. Prime mess beef. I bet. And some of the other things that were actually brought up from the wreck as well. Everyday domestic type of things, which are quite interesting. And again, these go to our nice big pottery pot. And now with these, they're not sure whether these actually came from the actual William Salt House as well. In some cases, you actually will have debris from the sea actually washing onto a shipwreck. So it's very hard to say whether this was actually worn by a sailor at the time or whether it's come from 30 k's down the coast, someone's thrown it into the cliff, you know what I mean? So there's all these sort of things as well. But what I can find out is quite unusual to find pieces of clothing, because usually they... This is actually from this isn't from the William Salt Pass, this is from the Clonmel. Often what is found is, of course, cutlery, but knives aren't often found because the blades actually disintegrate, apparently, because they're made of steel. So in fact they actually corrode, so you find lots of knife handles, but you don't actually find that. So if that all, people just didn't use knives in that day, I mean.
Actually, down at Warrnambool, when we saw that, they thought that so many of those men always carried a knife in the belt, and they actually used that knife for eating, you know, cutting and eating, so that they didn't have an implement.
But that's the sort of condition they come up on, and if any of you are interested, oh, no, you've got an open day next weekend, haven't you? Well, if any of you are interested, on Monday, the conservation laboratory is actually open for tours during the day. So if you want to come along and see. No, the following Monday. Yeah, Sunday and the Monday, but you've of course got your open days. Again, these are from the Clonmel. I always say Clinique. It must be missing. And this actually is part of the plumbing of the actual ship. So again, these have actually, some conservation work has been done on these, so you can see how they've started to clean them up. And you have beautiful objects like that as well. Okay, and that's basically it. So, look, sorry I've gone over time.
And that's the most interesting. I'm sure if there's any more questions, although Sarah and Jane have been very kind to
include
us in the conversation, and that as it's gone along, and that's been great. Is there a query anyone does have at the moment that you'd like to... Okay.
Before we move on, I'll just leave out for you to have a look if you want to before we go. There's a few bits of things we've bought. There's a little fish thing we showed you.
Clear the table and
some doll's legs from Viewbank. Often we get bits of doll and the plaster. And these are my favourite. I always take these when I go out because just because I love them and I think they're absolutely gorgeous for no particular reason. These are from the Fiji, which sank in 1891, and they're little clay animals, and we think they were children's toys. I think that's a lovely story because I know people actually died on that particular wreck, and I sort of think, well, this actually belonged to some little girl or little boy. But anyway, you're quite welcome to have a look at those. And I'd like to thank you for inviting us both.
Oh, very pleased. And I'll just ask Barbara to thank you on that.
Oh, for a little...
thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
we
you.
We admire your work. And keep it up.
We will. Thanks very much.
Can I throw in an ad? No, it's just from our point of view... Sarah made the mention about shipwrecks over 75 years or automatically protected. In Victoria, so are all historical archaeological sites, and by definition, effectively anything that's older than 50 years will fit into that. So we do have just basic site reporting forms, which perhaps we could send some to you. If anyone knows of anywhere that you think is somewhere that we should have on our inventory, and especially if you're concerned that something might be done to it, they are protected. Whether we know about them or not, the legislation is quite broad. They are protected. So we're always happy to hear if there's anything you're aware of that's done. But you feel might fit into a category of archaeology, then we'd be more than delighted to hear about it. Mm-hmm. So do let us know.
Yes. Maybe what we have you here, as you mentioned before about the clay, or what we've known as Wonderlic in more recent times, it's had several names, but that the Heritage Council has put an order on that. But I guess one of our concerns is the ongoing maintenance of that and the watching of it. Now, do you see local societies such as ours having a role in that, and then, you know, if it it is deteriorating, what can be done in actual fact by the privately owned buildings or whatever it might be that we're trying to keep.
It's very difficult for us to enforce maintenance on people.
Mm.
Whilst we can, under the Act, we can place something on the register and there is a requirement then if any works are to be done, unless a permit exemption has been granted, then it is necessary that any works done are approved by us. Within the Act, we do have the ability to insist on maintenance works being done if something is deliberately being let run into the ground.
Mm.
To the best of my knowledge, that's never ever been enacted or imposed on anybody, because as soon as it gets back down to a cost issue, there are arguments about the economic viability of actually doing that sort of work. What we can do, though, to assist is that we have got access to funding, and we do have funds that are available for emergency works, either as a low-interest loan or as a grant, depending on the capacity of the owners to pay it back and their status. For example, we'd be more likely to make a grant to a historical society who might own something as against a private individual who is running it.
Mm-hmm.
So there is, financially, there is that ability there. As far as the, I mean, I think groups such as yourselves are extremely important from a maintenance point of view.
Mm.
From a local community education and lobbying role, if nothing else.
Mm. And a watchdog as well. I mean, yeah, that's often how we have the ability to go out to an area where something's, you know, the bulldozer's outside and we think it should be on the register, and often it's local historical societies that ring us up and say, I think you should come and have a look at that.
Yeah.
And so then we can actually go out and do that. But,
yeah, so I think we were very early involved. Bill was president at the time when the works were happening, you know, down at this particular site, and the stack and drying sheets, isn't the stack have now been kept.
Mm. Mm.
So thank you for that.
Mm.
Yes, now we'll have a cup of tea. You've more than earned a cup of tea.
Thank you very much.
And I'm quite sure Sarah and Jane will be happy to continue any sort of information.
Just maybe before we do break up, we should get some more details of the ability to go and have a look at the conservation. On the Monday, in your brochure, have you seen,
we have got a brochure.
They're lovely, aren't they? They're quite...